Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I can't tell you how excited I am to invite our guest onto the show, Danny Weisfield. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Are you going to tell everybody how we know each other?
I am going to tell. So we actually go way back. Daniel is actually the person that in this space that I've known the longest. And it goes back to junior high school when we went to the same junior high school in Los Altos, California. And I just think that's really special that we have this connection now. So just really happy to have you on.
So I'm not allowed to call you Suji, right? I'm supposed to call you Sujata?
No, you can call me Suji. That was my
name. Okay, I will call you Suji. And little known fact for your listeners, Suji was a super fast runner. I remember very well her kicking butt on the track team. And Suji was in like a special math class for like special super smart kids. They were like, it was Suji and two other girls who had like the special advanced class. Cause I think we maxed out like pre-algebra or something. And you guys had like your own algebra class in middle school.
Thanks, Danny. I appreciate that. And yeah, I appreciate that. It was a long time ago and, you know, but anyways, well, I'm really happy. I mean, I came to know that you were in the same space as me through a mutual friend of ours, Laura Hess. And Laura let me know that. And I looked you up and I was like, wow, Daniel's like so into this space and he's just doing amazing things in the mobile home park space. And so it was just really cool to come to you that way. And anyway, so thank you for being here. Share with us, you know, I'd love to hear just obviously your third generation mobile home park operator. How did you come into this space? And you had a long career before this. Like, what made you come back to mobile home parks?
So I am a third generation mobile home park investor, as you noted. I think your question kind of requires a little bit of family history.
Yeah.
So to provide the context, my mom was born on a chicken farm in Israel. And so was my grandfather. And they came to the States in the 60s seeking opportunity. And they came to America really with nothing. And my grandfather worked as a car mechanic. He started buying wrecked cars at a junkyard and he'd fix them in his backyard and he would sell them for a profit. And eventually saved up enough to buy, to rent a mechanic's shop. And then he saved up enough to buy a mobile home park. So that was around 40 years ago. So, you know, when we were kids, in the summertime, I would go up to Seattle to visit my grandfather and I'd go to the body shop where I'd help him, you know, paint a bumper or fix cars, whatever it was. And then we'd go over to his mobile home park and we would mow the lawn, paint the fence, dig out the trash, dig ditches, fix pipes, whatever needed to get done.
Amazing.
So I grew up around with this role model, the very hands-on entrepreneur, right? Who was not necessarily sophisticated, like in a Wall Street kind of way, but was very entrepreneurial and had a great sense of detecting opportunity and kind of striking to capitalize on those opportunities. So that's, I kind of grew up around that business and it was in my family, it was in my blood. It's not what I thought I was going to do when I grew up at all. So I went off to college. I then worked as a US diplomat. I then got a law degree. Yeah. I got an MBA. I worked at a company called McKinsey doing strategy consulting. And then finally in 2017, I realized that this family business that was kind of unsexy that I always associated with my immigrant grandfather actually is an amazing business. It's such an important way to provide affordable housing to people who need that. And it provides great, reliable returns for investors. So that was kind of the genesis of starting Three Pillar Communities with my partner 5 years ago.
Very, very interesting background. Just a couple of questions that I will have about that. Do you think your grandfather
Do you think he had the wherewithal to like know that he wanted to invest in real estate to build generational wealth, or where was his thinking around that?
100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, it depends on how far back you want to go on this question. But I mean, my grandfather was, you know, his parents immigrated to Israel from Romania and Poland, where they were like fleeing ethnic violence, mm-hmm. right? There were like anti-Jewish pogroms. There's a lot of violence. And, you know, in his parents' generation, you know, Jews weren't allowed to own land. Mm, right. It was kind of forbidden for Jews to own real estate. If you look at kind of Eastern European history. So yeah, he had a deep craving to own land, to own real estate, and to have something that you can call your own. And America's amazing, right? He mm-hmm. came to America and he was like, wow, there is rule of law. There is secure title. When you own something, you really own it. Mm-hmm. There is equal protection under the law, right? As like an immigrant or a religious minority or, you know, whatever it is, you have the right to own property. And then there's all these banks that will lend you money. It's like the golden land. It was like totally amazing to him. So he was absolutely interested in using leverage to buy cash flow and real estate. And, you know, he saved money from that first park and went and bought a second one. He did a cash out refinancing and bought a second one and worked on that for a while and, you know, bought a third one. So he always, you know, from a young age, he taught me about the power of leverage and banks and interest rates and how, you know, leverage is your friend. You want to use loans in order to expand your holdings.
Yeah. Wow. So cool. That just gives me chills just like hearing that history. Cause for a lot of us who grew up in this country, even though my parents grew up in India, it's just so enlightening to hear just how good we have it here in terms of being able to actually build a business on land, et cetera. I was also wondering, when you were growing up, you know, you said you never thought you were going to do this. What did you think you, I mean, obviously you were a US diplomat and, but like, what was it that wasn't, that was like sexier or more appealing about these other career paths?
Honestly, it's kind of a false, I don't know, false comparison because I literally never considered the mobile home park career path.
Interesting.
It's not like I was considering it versus other things and other things won. It's like, it's the same way that a fish doesn't know it's in water. Like it literally never occurred to me that I would do mobile home parks. Like it was this thing that existed in the background that my family did. And it was totally detached from my life, which was like going to Yale and like wanting to go do these things that I thought were exciting, like diplomacy or constitutional law or journalism or advising like big companies on strategic questions. So that was kind of on that path doing those things. And then I just had like a really introspective moment, basically, where I had to decide like, who do I actually want to be when I grow up? And, you know, I was at McKinsey and I looked around me at kind of partners who had like kind of stuck on that path and stayed in that company. I looked at my peers who left the company, went and kind of joined startups or joined Fortune 500 companies. And I just realized I didn't want to do any of those things. Like I actually wanted to be like my grandfather, like be an entrepreneur, be a value creator, actually get my hands dirty, like do it myself instead of being in a corporate role. And it was kind of like realizing where I came from.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to emulate.
Yeah. Very interesting. I think that's just so awesome that you kind of came around back to mobile home parks and what your grandfather did. Was there a reason that you decided to focus on mobile home parks? I mean, because there are other commercial real estate classes like multifamily, self-storage, et cetera. Obviously, there's a lot of great things to love about mobile home parks, but what was it for you? Do you think it was that legacy or was it the asset class itself?
It's a great question. So my thought process, first of all, was I'm going to leave my W-2 job and go do real estate. That was the first thing. Mm-hmm. And then I did a whole job search within real estate. And I looked at a ton of options and I did a ton of coffee chats. And I finally decided, okay, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to start my own company. And then I looked at all these different asset classes, like you just suggested. And my initial hypothesis, I was living in Oakland, California at the time. And I thought, I want to do urban infill, right? The Bay Area has a housing crisis. I want to develop high density housing near BART stations, right? Near transit. That's what we need. So that was my initial hypothesis. And then I started looking more at, okay, what if I try and go be an urban infill developer in Oakland? What does that path look like? And I'm competing with all these really smart people who are trying to do it also. And they've been doing it longer than I have. And I didn't quite know how to break in. And then I finally looked at mobile home parks and I'm like, it's a stellar asset class. It performs whether the economy is up or down. And I can get a running start because of my family story, right? And even if my family was not very sophisticated. And even if I didn't learn, you know, a lot of technical skills from them about how to run mobile home parks, there was, I think, a lot of power just to say that, hey, my family's been doing this for three generations hey, broker, will you show me a deal? Mm-hmm. Right? Or hey, investors, will you write me a check? Even though I'm unproven, this is my first deal, but my family's been doing it for a long time. I've got kind of a support network here. It made it easier to take that risk.
Yeah, for sure. And what are your thoughts now about urban infill development? I mean, I'm asking this kind of on a personal level because I still have an interest in one day doing urban infill housing development. And just curious, like, if that's ever something you would consider or, yeah.
So I would absolutely consider investing in those deals as an LP,
yeah.
as a passive investor, right? Yeah. And I have invested in those deals with, you know, smart, competent sponsors who know that space, know their markets, and I trust that they're buying it right at the right basis. They have the right plan they can execute. Like I myself would not want to step into Oakland, California and try and get a project developed. Like it's a whole other skill set. It's a whole other landscape.
Yeah. And you're happy in mobile home parks. And
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, I am looking at other product types. So we recently, it's something we've been incubating, developing other types of real estate that we have the competence to go buy. And so we have just closed on our first industrial real estate deal. We have our second and third in contract. So we're starting to do some industrial stuff. But again, we're doing that kind of through a joint venture format with my partner, who's been doing industrial real estate for 20 years and really knows the space up and down. So there's a world where we would go do multifamily kind of ourselves, but with the JV partner.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, that's interesting. And another great asset class, industrial also. Okay, great. So now I want to just turn to your mobile home park specialty. So tell me what it is that you love about mobile home parks.
Sure. So I think for your listeners who don't know what a mobile home park is, let me first give the 15-second snapshot of what the business is.
Yeah.
And then why I like it. So the basic business model is, when we acquire a mobile home park, we are buying land and infrastructure, and our residents own their own homes, which sit on top of the land. So they own the home, we own the land, and they pay us monthly lot rent. What that means is our residents are homeowners. So they actually build wealth by owning a home, which appreciates in value over time. Mm-hmm. So that makes me feel really good about what we're doing from a social impact perspective. Number two, we have very stable tenants. Because literally, they buy a home in our community. Typically, they'll stay for 8 or 10 years or longer.
Yeah.
Number three, we have lower operating expenses than, you know, an apartment deal. Because our tenants own their own home. They take care of their home. If they need to change a light bulb, that's their responsibility because it's their home. We're taking care of the common areas and the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Number four, our project is deeply affordable. So, you know, in a typical city where renting a two-bedroom apartment might cost $1,800. Renting a mobile home lot might cost $700.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real bargain for our residents. Mm-hmm. They love the product for that reason. And five, last but not least, the reason I love mobile home parks is tax benefits. We get very special tax treatment compared to other types of real estate, which I can explain in more detail if you're interested. So that's the high level view on why I love our product. It's affordable housing. It's creating homeowners, and it's a very reliable source of income for our investors.
Yeah, for sure. All really valid and points that I get excited about too. I'm also curious just to hear from your perspective, because I mean, I'm sure you're aware and that mobile home parks kind of, and mobile home park private equity going into buying mobile home parks, there's kind of like this negative story in the news about it. Like private equity is going in and raising rents and people can't afford it. And mobile home parks seem to get like the brunt of this, like even more than like multifamily in terms of negative press and ideas about what's going on in the parks. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think we really need to educate people about the value of what we provide. And we have a housing affordability crisis in this country. And mobile home parks are part of the solution, not the problem. I really believe this deeply.
Yeah.
Mobile home park investors like me are buying assets that are often dilapidated because they were built in the 50s or 60s and infrastructure is failing. And we go in and we rebuild infrastructure, pave the roads, put up street lighting, you know, improve safety, make it an attractive community that our residents are proud to call home. Help our residents, if they want to, replace their old 1970s homes that don't meet current safety standards with brand new, attractive, energy efficient homes, right? So we're doing this and we're creating affordable neighborhoods with lot rents that are way cheaper than renting an apartment. And our residents actually build home equity, right? Mm-hmm. They build wealth by owning a home in that community. And we're doing this without government subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
Right? This is amazing. And so many folks, especially on the left side of the political spectrum, who say they care about housing affordability and say they want to increase the supply of affordable housing are criticizing us. And I'm like, no, we are the solution. You should want more of this.
Yeah, totally.
So that's my basic view.
For sure. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I feel that deeply as well. And it just comes up a lot. So I just wanted to get your eloquent take on it. I also wanted to ask, so in terms of just our overall affordability, housing crisis in this country, I mean, since mobile home parks are such an attractive option, as I understand it, a lot of cities are not allowing new parks to be built. So that would then, you know, constrict the supply and then continue to drive pricing up. I'm just curious if you could speak to that a little bit. And if there's maybe for listeners who don't know why, first of all, like why cities are not approving new mobile home parks, and then, you know, what we can do about the constricted supply that might be forthcoming.
Yeah. So I would say mobile home parks are the most stigmatized form of housing that exists in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So if you think of a mobile home park, what associations come to mind? Yeah. Oh, seriously.
Actually. Meth labs. I mean, no, like I've had, this is like back, you know, 5 years ago, meth labs, like crime, kind of like people who aren't working and just, they're maybe dirty.
Exactly. That is the stereotype that's perpetuated by the media, right? Yes. So that's the image a lot of people have in mind when they hear the word mobile home park. And they don't realize that, you know, what we are actually providing is a really high quality form of affordable housing for normal people, right? Yeah. The people who work in your community to make your community function, right?
Yeah. I remember really quick, we didn't go to the same high school, but I remember one of my high school teachers lived, like at some point it was like revealed to me that they lived in like a mobile home park. And I just remember being like aghast. I was like, oh my God. And I just felt so sorry for them. And like, I couldn't possibly understand how someone who was so smart and like working in our, and it wasn't until years later when I realized that like, there's lots of different, I mean, that there's just large variety and just learn more about mobile home parks. I'm like, no, that's actually a really affordable place to live where, and a lot of them, like the ones you're working on, have been improved to the state that they're just really nice communities and affordable also.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. That's exactly right. There's this, people put mobile home parks in this separate mental category of like the other.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And for that reason, there has been very little development of new mobile home parks in the US over the past 40 years.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Okay, so one reason I thought that, and I would like your clarification on this, I was under the impression that also cities aren't able to tax mobile home parks in the same way that they're able to tax like regular single family homes. And that's another reason why they're not excited about them. What do you think about that?
There may be some validity to that, but I don't think that's actually like the driving reason for this.
Okay.
I think basically when you're looking at getting land use approval for any type of development, you're going in front of a planning and zoning professional, right? And then it often goes to a planning and zoning board, which is appointed. And sometimes it even goes up for a city council vote, right? And typically the big motivations there are around community sentiment, right? And people might cite all sorts of justifications about the tax base or traffic or density or schools. People come up with all sorts of reasons. But typically if a community wants to build more affordable workforce housing because they realize they need to house people in their community, they'll make it happen. And if they don't want it, they'll come up with stories about taxation or traffic or other stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are one of the few groups that's actively developing new manufactured housing communities in the US. And we've kind of had a night and day experience in two different cities. In one city, Bozeman, Montana, they have an affordable housing crisis. The median home price over the past 2 years has gone up from $400K to $700K.
Wow.
And normal people just can't afford a place to live.
Yeah.
And we went and talked to their direct, we tied up 90 acres. We went and talked to their head of planning. And he was like, yes,
Mm-hmm.
I live in a manufactured home. That doesn't scare me at all. And this is exactly what we need to provide housing for teachers and nurses and firefighters and ski instructors and, you know, small business owners, everybody else. Yes, like, please, let's get this thing done.
Yeah.
We had a very different experience in Donnelly, Idaho, where we proposed a similar type of project. It was going to be, you know, a class A manufactured housing community, large lots, beautiful new homes, you know, walking trails, a dog park, playground for the kids, you know, built to the standards of a subdivision.
Yeah.
And the community came up with a lot of reasons why they did not want any type of manufactured housing community in their backyard. It's still an active discussion. We are trying to go back and make it happen, but we've gotten a very different reaction.
Okay. So in that case, just curious from a developer's perspective, did you have that land under contract and you bought
Correct.
It? Okay. And so
the land in Donnelly, Idaho is under contract, and our contract gives us, you know, we don't have to close until we get entitlements that we're seeking.
Okay. Yeah. And then, I mean, just so listeners understand the risk that's involved for you, if you aren't able to receive those entitlements, like, do you have a plan B, or will you just lose your investment?
We have a plan B. I mean, there is, just so Donnelly, Idaho, just for those folks who don't know, number one, Idaho is the fastest growing state in the country right now in terms of population growth, right?
Yeah.
Boise is the epicenter of that. Mm-hmm. Donnelly is 2 or 3 hours north of Boise, and that's where Boise people go skiing. So it's right near McCall. It's a big ski resort. It's getting a lot of new investment. It's an area that, because it's a ski resort and very attractive recreationally, has a lot of need for workforce housing and not enough workforce housing.
Yeah.
So we thought manufactured housing community made a ton of sense here, and I still believe that. However, to answer your question, if we don't get approvals, yeah, we do have a plan.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about it too much.
Don't worry about
it. It's an ongoing issue, but there's plenty of housing demand in the region. We have a plan.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. I'm curious now, just like to talk about a little bit about the nuts and bolts of like the affordability. So like, let's just take the Bozeman example for this park in Bozeman. I'm not sure the best way, like, what will you be able to, in terms of affordability, if it, like, the average house price is now $700,000 in Bozeman, like, what will this new park be able to provide for residents?
Yeah. So we will be selling homes for starting in the low to mid 200,000 range, call it 250,000 for a starter home, which might be roughly 900 square feet, 2 or 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, granite countertops, stainless steel appliances, nice wood cabinets.
Wow.
You can, you know, add a gas fireplace as an option. You know, it's a nice house.
Yeah.
So that will be roughly 250,000. And our higher end models will be around 350,000. That'll be, you know, 1400 to 1600 square feet, 3 bedroom, 2 bath, a really nice house.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
So our tenants will own that home. That home will appreciate over time. I mean, there is risk in the market always, but to the same extent that a single family house would appreciate, I believe these manufactured homes will appreciate the same way.
Yeah.
And they will pay a community membership fee, which you might also call lot rent, which will be between $700 and $900 a month to be determined.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think, and would you call this a class? I mean, I know, is this class A or class B?
Absolutely. This will be a class A community for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And obviously speaks to the affordability of the asset class. I mean, to be able to build that kind of housing in today's market and be able to offer it at those types of prices is, you know, the quality that you're discussing is just very, very powerful and compelling. And the types of folks who would be living in this, are these workforce housing people or students? What would you say for Bozeman, like, the target market is?
So our target customer is a household earning between $60,000 and $100,000 a year.
Okay.
So a household earning $60,000 a year, that could be, you know, two folks, a couple, right? Earning $20 an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
Right? Who each earn $20 an hour in, you know, as a shift manager in retail or a restaurant or something like that. Or it could be, you know, the middle-class jobs I talked about, like teachers and nurses and firefighters or small business owners. That's our target market. Probably not students. And we're not trying to provide ultra low income housing, right?
Yeah.
If you're on a fixed income receiving government assistance, you know, earning $20,000, $30,000 a year, you're not going to be the target customer for this project.
For this park. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then another question about the houses, you know, you mentioned they're going to appreciate. Do manufactured homes, is there any sort of difference that you perceive between a manufactured home and like a home that's attached to a foundation in terms of how it appreciates and like what would affect that?
So it was either Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. I forget which of the government agencies did a really interesting study on this a couple of years ago, showing that manufactured homes actually appreciate like site-built houses.
Interesting.
And there's another study done last year showing the appreciation rate of manufactured homes across the U.S. compared to conventional single-family homes based on census data, kind of the American Community Study. And it showed that manufactured homes have appreciated faster than single-family homes.
Wow.
Over the past decade. Part of that is because the starting point for manufactured homes was low, right? Because, you know, maybe 10 years ago, the average price point across the U.S. might have been 10,000, 15,000, maybe 20. And at this point, you know, it's a lot higher than that. So, you know, anecdotally, I'll tell you about the best example of this. We own a park in Brookings, Oregon called Emerald Coast Estates. It's a Class A manufactured housing community, gated community, ocean views. It's got a pool. It's got a clubhouse. Gorgeous. When manufactured homes were first sold there in the 1990s, they sold for around $120,000 each. Now, those same homes that are 30 years old are trading for $300,000
to $350,000. Wow.
Yeah. So they really appreciate, and there's a giant misconception around this. So I'm always trying to educate people that when residents buy homes in our parks, they are making an investment, which generally helps put dollars in their pockets.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I do think that there is a story out there that these homes are depreciating assets because they're somehow, for some reason, I mean, but because the folks own them, they have a pride of ownership. And tell me if this is, tracks with what your view is. They have a pride of ownership. It's their home. And so they are very content to like maintain it and continue to own it and take good care of the asset itself. Does that track with what your experience is?
Yeah. So there's a little more nuance. I mean, to get into the logic a little bit more.
Yeah.
If you take a brand new manufactured home today that costs, let's say it's $70,000 coming out of the factory for what we call a single wide manufactured home, and you haul it to a cornfield in Ohio and you leave it there for the next 30 years and it deteriorates and rots and no one lives nearby, it is not going to appreciate in value, right? It will depreciate in value, and kind of like driving a car, it starts depreciating over time. But if you install that same home in a manufactured housing community in a market where there's housing demand and where there is a limitation on the number of manufactured home lots that are available, so not that many places where you can put a home like that, then it behaves like real estate, right? It's installed on a lot. There's value in having a place to live in a place where people want to live, and there's jobs nearby and schools and other things. And then the home appreciates over time.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Right. And that's part of the value that operators like you are bringing and actually helping people own assets that are appreciating, is you're creating these really nice communities that people are proud to call home. They're in markets where people, where there's a need for housing, which is a lot of places. And that's part of what causes those assets to appreciate. So that makes it a lot of sense, but they're not going to actually physically deteriorate faster than a site built house.
No, I mean, I would say that if anything, the construction standard on these homes is probably higher than what you would find in a typical, let's say, entry-level subdivision. Because an entry-level subdivision, you've got a contractor trying to, you know, build homes as fast and as cheap as possible, get them sold to the end customer. And there is not rigorous inspection and supervision.
Okay.
I mean, you've got a local building inspector, but it is what it is. A factory-built home is built to federal code.
Interesting.
And has federal inspectors, you know, checking the box on the original plan, what materials are allowed to be used. There are multiple levels of inspection. And these homes are built using, you know, 30-year shingles, great exterior siding, you know, 2x6 framing, kind of all at this point using the same construction materials you would expect from a single family home.
Yeah, very interesting. I really did not know that aspect about it. And it's very encouraging for the space. So what do you see as like a path forward in terms of, I know education is a big part of it, but in terms of like actually creating a pathway for more mobile home parks to be developed and for the misconceptions about them to be broken down and for cities to say, yes, we want these here. I mean, how can we get more people like the guy in Bozeman who want mobile home parks and affordable housing?
So I think the basic answer is we need more proof points. We need more of these early projects to get done. Mm-hmm. So then we can show up in, you know, any city across the country and point this thing and say, hey, look at this new project that we just built in Bozeman, Montana. It's awesome, right? We built 250 new affordable homes. Look at, you know, Jorge and Maria who live here and they are employed in the community, and here's their kid. They're riding their bike. Here's a picture. They bought a house. It's appreciated in value. It's awesome. Or here's Kate. She's a teacher. She bought this house. It's awesome, right? We need to be able to personalize it and show these actual success stories. And I think that will make the case much easier, because in so many cities, housing affordability is like the number one political issue.
Yeah. Right?
And people are looking for solutions. They just haven't fully realized what a powerful solution manufactured housing is.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. And then also, why is it less expensive to build manufactured housing as compared to site-filled housing?
So imagine any other product, like a computer. If you were going to build a computer in a factory where you're building 1,000 computers a week versus going out to some random muddy construction site and trying to build the computer at that construction site, where do you think it's going to be cheaper, easier, and faster?
Yeah.
It's obviously going to be cheaper, easier, and faster in the factory,
yeah.
Right? You're doing 10 of them a day on the same assembly line with the same people. Each person knows their role. You have a purchasing department. You have all the materials right there. You're following a playbook and you know, it's rinse and repeat. Versus when you do it out on site, you're trying to coordinate all sorts of different trades. No one's worked with each other before. You've got delays getting the materials to the site. You're doing everything custom and got, you know, chopping the materials up. There's a lot of waste. So I think it's just kind of intuitive that building something in a factory will be faster and cheaper and more efficient. And it kind of surprises me that we're not doing more factory-built housing. I mean, housing is one of the few industries where we're generally still doing it the same way we did it 100 years ago. And it's ripe for disruption.
Yeah, for sure. What about there's like modular building, which is gaining some traction, as I understand it, and it's becoming more, I mean, there's more and more of it, which is where parts of a site-built house are built in these factories. And then does that kind of, I mean, how would you distinguish that from mobile home parks and the attractiveness of that product type versus mobile home parks or manufactured housing?
So modular housing is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge proponent of it, both for single family housing, as well as for kind of, you know, multi-story commercial structures like hotels. I've stayed in hotels that were modular, or apartment buildings or schools, right? You can ship boxes and stack them on top of each other and create a structure. It's great. It's cheaper and more efficient than building everything on site. So I'm a huge fan. I think the distinction versus what we do is we create neighborhoods that are using manufactured homes that are built to the federal HUD code. HUD is the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. There is a code all about the safety requirements for building a manufactured home. In order for one of our homes to be habitable and to get a permit and to be allowed in one of our communities, it needs to meet that standard. And so typically it's single story, and there are certain other design features that you'll see.
Okay. And from affordability standpoint, is it like, I mean, obviously
ours will be more affordable.
They'll still be more affordable because it's like building the whole thing in the factory.
Exactly. Like, if a HUD code home has to be kind of a complete dwelling in order to meet HUD standards. So when it gets shipped to a site, it has bedrooms and bathrooms and kitchens, and it's either in, you know, one box that's fully built as a house on wheels, or two or three boxes that get kind of installed and tied together. But there's not a lot of site-built customization.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And then another question sort of related is, are your residents able to install like solar panels, for example, on their homes just to increase their, you know, affordability of their lots?
Yes.
Cool.
But better yet, we have spent millions of dollars, or I should say invested millions of dollars, to build community level solar systems.
Okay.
So we built a 600 kilowatt system at one of our mobile home parks in Northern California. We invested around $1.5 million on that one. We just finished a solar project at another park we own in Bakersfield, California. It's a total win, right? It's taking greenhouse gases out of the system. It's providing green energy to our residents, and it creates tax benefits for our investors and increases the property net operating income, which will ultimately drive property value.
So you're able to build these and provide electricity to the tenants, and then they pay you guys. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
So we can't do that at every park. Kind of, it needs to be sub-metered. It needs to have high solar incidence. We need to have enough land to build that system. So there are certain cases where kind of the stars align for us to build a community level solar system.
Yeah.
But getting back to your question at the individual homeowner level, absolutely. They can install rooftop solar. And in fact, some of the factories we work with even have a solar ready option when we buy the home, which includes like easy mounting brackets on the roof and a direct feed from the home's electrical panel up to the rooftop in order to, you know, make it easier to power the system.
Yeah, very cool. That's awesome. I just love hearing that things are moving in that direction. Awesome. Well, we have talked for a long time, Danny. Thank you so much for coming on and just sharing all about your passion and just educating us all on the space. It's been really enlightening and really appreciate it. I would love for you to share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and your firm and anything else you want to share.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was fun. If anyone wants to learn more about manufactured housing or three-pillar communities, check us out at threepillarcommunities.com. It's spelled out T-H-R-E-E, pillarcommunities.com.
Awesome. Well, I definitely hope you all, encourage you all to go and check out what Daniel's got going on with Three Pillar Communities. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been super fun to have you, and we'll see you next time, Danny.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.